So our next presenter is Kathy Backinger, who is Deputy Director for Research in the Office of Science in the Center for Tobacco Products at the FDA, where she leads the research program. The title of her talk, as you can see, is Expanding the Research Base to Include Tobacco Product Regulation. While Kathy is coming to the podium, I would just like to say that there are brochures up here for the alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs section sessions at the meeting, so please feel free after the session is over to come up and pick up a brochure. They're also available at the booth and the convention center.
Thank you. So it's just the usual to advance this, the arrow, I'm assuming?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for coming this morning. As Deborah said, I'm with, and Ashley also pre-introduced me, I'm with the Office of Science in the Center for Tobacco Products. So what I'm going to do over the next, hopefully I'll be shorter than 20 minutes, just to talk about how we're intersecting with the rest of CTP and what we're doing in the area of research. And I should say that up at the table we have just a one-page handout about some of our research interests, if you'd like to pick that up. And I hope it has the website as well, so that information is there. So the disclaimer, I should point out that anything that I present is not a formal dissemination or information by FDA, does not represent agency position or policy. And I should also add, if I happen to mention a specific brand of a tobacco product during my talk or in the discussion, question and answer, it's just an example. It's just an example. It doesn't mean anything about what. That's right, I'm not promoting it. Thank you very much. And the disclosure, I have no financial relationships to disclose. So I want to just drill down a little bit more from what Ashley was talking about, which were the pathways to market, and talk about how the Office of Science looks at these applications. I think Ashley mentioned that in the Office of Science is actually where the review of any tobacco product application happens. And in fact, in our office, we have teams of chemists, engineers, toxicologists, behavioral pharmacologists, neuroscientists, physicians, social scientists, epidemiologists, statisticians, there's many other. We have a very large group of scientists within the Office of Science to actually view tobacco product applications. So under substantial equivalence, as Ashley talked about, what we look for is, does this product have the same characteristics as a predicate, meaning one that's already on the market, or do the changes in that product actually raise new questions of public health? And Ashley did talk about the public health standards, so not just at an individual level, but taking the population into consideration as a whole. So what do we look at? We have to look at the design features, so that's why we need to have engineers there. How is it actually put together? Look at the ingredients, the materials, the heating source, the composition. And I'm not going to read all of these, but we need to look at a whole range of scientific areas in order to determine whether the product is actually substantially equivalent or not. Within the pre-market tobacco product area, which is Section 910, we have to look at, so this is a new tobacco product, and our primary question that we want to answer when we look at those applications is, would permitting such a product to be marketed be appropriate for the protection of public health? So a little different of, does it raise new questions of public health versus, is this appropriate for the protection of public health? And again, as Ashley pointed out about the safety and efficacy standard, which does not apply to CTP, all of these products are not safe. And I guess, you would say they are effective because if you want to consider effectiveness in killing half of its users prematurely. But so what is appropriate for protection of public health? Obviously, we don't want to introduce anything that would be more harmful than the products that are currently on the market. So again, we have to look in pre-market applications, we have to look at health risks, for example. So this is a little more in-depth. We have non-clinical studies that the industry could submit, as well as human subject studies. When we get to modified risk tobacco products, which is Section 911, we have to answer scientifically, would marketing of the product that's under consideration significantly reduce harm and the risk of tobacco-related disease and benefit the health of the population as a whole? So again, it's not just an individual risk, but would this product that may have a lower individual risk, but would it mean that youth would initiate the product, or would it mean that former users would take it up, or would current tobacco users just decrease their consumption and use this product, so thereby maybe perhaps not decreasing their risk at all? So we have to look at a wide range of scientific areas with these products as well. So this is just kind of a segue into what are some of our research needs. And it's interesting, I was giving a talk last week and talked about running into an old friend, and she said, "Well, don't we know everything about tobacco? We know it's bad. What else do we need to do research on?" Well, now I'm here to tell you about that. Before I do that, I forgot tobacco product standards. Ashley touched on this as well, but we want to look at what standards could we implement from an agency perspective that would protect the public health. And Ashley touched on nicotine yields. And again, not down to zero, but we could reduce or eliminate different constituents in tobacco products, including the smoke constituents. We could, again, if it protects public health, change the construction, components, ingredients, additives, and constituents. And don't ask me the difference between some of those, but there are definitions of that. How, you know, restricting sale and distribution, we can change the labeling on the product if we thought that would decrease the risk of the product. So let me move now into our research priorities. So when I first joined CTP, which was in June of 2011, one of the first things that I was asked to do was to help put together a research agenda for the Center for Tobacco Products. And we came up with these seven topical areas, and I'm going to touch briefly on each one of them, so I won't read these to you now. As I said before, this just gives you an overview of what those seven topic areas are in the website to find out the specific questions that we're interested in. Embedded in that, we do recognize that there's certain subpopulations that are incredibly important that we want to make sure that we capture in any research and actually in any regulation or issue or any kind of regulatory action that we take, because it's important that we want to look at the population as a whole, but we also understand that tobacco use and then morbidity and mortality are different among different populations. So with regard to diversity of tobacco product, as a tobacco product is defined as any product made or derived from tobacco intended for human consumption, and Ashley already talked about which of those products that we actually currently regulate. But as we all know, there's lots of, and I think one of the other presentations this morning are going to talk about other tobacco products for which CTP does not currently regulate, but there's lots of products out there that meet the definition of a tobacco product, such as e-cigarettes. They contain nicotine, and nicotine is derived from tobacco, although it can be manufactured nicotine can be manufactured synthetically, but since it's expensive, most of it is, to our knowledge, is come from tobacco products, or from tobacco. So just for some examples of the research areas that we're interested as far as diversity, we actually need to understand what's in those products, how they're designed, how people actually use them, and what people think about them. So for example, are little cigars actually smoked in the same way that cigarettes are? We have a hypothesis about that or an assumption, but we need the research to underpin have the scientific base if we're going to take action in products once we deem those. So moving on to addiction, as Ashley pointed out, we do have the authority to reduce nicotine, except just not down to zero. And so we need to understand what's the dependence in relation to the nicotine level? I mean, I think most people are familiar with the Fagerstrom test, where you ask people how soon do you smoke a cigarette when you wake up, and if you smoke a cigarette within 5 minutes, then you're highly addicted. But at what point in that trajectory did you get to that point, and when did the nicotine receptor click in the brain and cause addiction? We need to understand how reducing nicotine actually affects behaviors. Do people compensate? Do they smoke more? Do they smoke other products? Or do they actually quit? If we're going to move forward with the product standard, we need to have the research that will help us, give us the evidence base for which to do that product standard. And then we also need to understand what other things in the tobacco products, what things are manipulated, what other constituents are there beyond nicotine that can affect addiction. So I think the Act, and I'm looking at our policy people, doesn't specify. I mean, we could do an addiction product standard, not just a nicotine. And of course, I'm just saying if, because these are things that we have to consider and work on within the Center for Tobacco Products. So moving on to reducing toxicity and carcinogenicity, as Ashley pointed out, one of our public health goals is reducing harms of tobacco. We can do a product standard around reducing toxicity and carcinogenicity, but we need to understand how a reduction in a specific toxin, what happens? How do people change their behavior or their perceptions? And does it actually decrease any kind of disease risk? And then we also need to have some methods development about what are the appropriate assays to compare toxicity. We're very interested in trying to tease out the differential effect among the different tobacco products. And I think everyone knows that, by and large, the research that we've done over the last 40, 50, 60 years have been with cigarettes, which makes sense because that's the predominant form of tobacco use in the United States. And to some lesser degree, we've had research around smokeless. But for the other tobacco products, we just don't have as much research, and we need to have, even though it may sound very elemental and make, of course, that's how it's going to be, we still need to have that research that will give us the scientific evidence. As far as adverse health consequences, we need to understand the health risks of multiple tobacco products. And it's not just individual or comparing one product to another, but as we know, there's a lot of dual use, and that's increasing, or even poly use in the United States. So understanding if people, as I mentioned before, if you decrease cigarette use, but you're also using another product, such as smokeless or a dissolvable or something like that, does that actually translate into any kind of what is the risk of that? We need to make sure that we have the appropriate biomarkers so that we can look at that disease risk and actually exposure. And then what are those markers that are predictive of adverse health outcomes? We all know that it takes years and years, decades, to actually see at least some, and in the cancer area, the result of using tobacco, and we need to have early markers so we can see differences and changes. As far as communications, I think Ashley touched a little bit on this as well. We need to have more research about how we can best effectively convey information about the risk of tobacco products. That is in our mandate in the Tobacco Control Act, is communicating with the public. And, what are the best methods to do that? What are the best communication channels? I mean, is it Twitter? I don't know. I have a teenager, and so he's on Twitter, but I'm not. But, social networking sites, YouTube, et cetera. And we also need to have research about how we can effectively convey what our regulatory authority is. So here we are, part of FDA, and I think most of the public knows that we regulate, drugs, and we regulate biologics and medical devices and veterinary medicine and foods, and that's protecting the public health. How does the public think about what we do with tobacco? Do people think that because now FDA regulates tobacco that it's somehow a safer product? And so we need to, communicate what our regulatory authority actually means to the general public. In the area of marketing, because we can regulate the marketing and distribution of products, we need to understand how the tobacco industry marketing is actually affecting use behaviors, perceptions, attitudes, beliefs, not just, and I mentioned all the populations of interest that we that I started out with, but it's particularly among youth. Even though it's illegal to sell the tobacco product to youth, obviously they're you know, getting tobacco products, and we need to understand how marketing impacts their use. And I mentioned in the last Brown Communications is how is the tobacco industry using different social media campaigns and other non-traditional communication strategies. So then that would all inform both what our actions could be with regard to marketing, but that would inform our communications as well. As far as economics and policies, I don't know if anyone, who's read when the graphic health warning rule came out? Who read the entire thing, which was like, I don't know, 300 pages? Okay, well, that's because you're an attorney. But most people read the front, I call it the front matter, which is the scientific evidence, how we came to develop the graphic health warnings, and then there's all this stuff that's in the back. And I should say I'm not an attorney, so I could misstep here, but you can correct me. But on the back, it's required for any rule that the government puts out that you have to do an impact analysis. And we need to have more economic research about what would be the possible economic impact of any regulatory action that we take. But that's when you get the rule, most of all the back matter is all the required government analyses that have to go into any rule. We also have to understand as we move along what our actions are on overall morbidity and mortality. I realize I just have a few minutes. So we're collaborating with many federal agencies, and we're doing research contracts with organizations that have particular expertise. I'm going to move quickly through this because I want to talk about the PATH study, and I realize I'm talking slower than I normally do because normally I'm a really fast talker. You'll see we're working with NIH for a number of research initiatives. We announced in July the Tobacco Centers of Regulatory Science. This is a big initiative, Centers of Excellence, that we funded in FY13. We have other research mechanisms available. I'm going to talk about PATH in just a minute. We're working with CDC, both the Division of Laboratory Sciences and the Office of Smoking and Health. The laboratory does analytical chemistry of tobacco products. We're working with them on a number of projects listed here, and we're also working with OSH on some national surveillance. We're also working with FDA's National Center for Toxicological Research to start a number of studies looking at inhalation tox, for example, and looking at animal models of drug self-administration. So I'm breezing through these in the interest of time. These are just a few of the contracts that we have up and running. We're working with RTI. We worked with RTI to actually develop the 9 graphic health warnings that was in the final rule, but we're continuing to work with them around research on consumer perceptions. We have data from the American Association of Poison Control Centers to look at reports of poisonings in children from tobacco products. And the last one, these are not all the contracts we have. We're also working with Battelle now. This was just awarded in September to look at how people are actually smoking little cigars. So let me move in my last couple of minutes to the population assessment of tobacco and health study. This, and I'm going to talk, I just have a couple minutes left, but this is our big cohort, nationally representative longitudinal cohort study. We're going to be enrolling almost 60,000 people into this study that's scheduled to go into the field in about a year from now, in both youth and adults, ages 12 and over. We're working with the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We have an interagency agreement with them. They awarded a contract to Westat, and as part of the contract, Dr. Andy Hyland, who's at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute, is the scientific lead for the PATH study. We're also collaborating with CDC on this study. They help with the study design, and they're also going to be doing some of the biospecimen analysis. So just in my couple remaining minutes, thank you, Deborah. So what are we going to do in PATH? We're going to collect survey data from both adults and youth, as well as parents of the youth enrolled in the study. And we're also going to collect biospecimens, urine, buccal cells, and blood, but only from the adults. We want to do this. We want to watch changes over time. We want to understand what's happening out in the public as far as tobacco use, so that will inform both our current and our future regulatory actions so we can meet our mandate under the Act. Specific aims include we want to understand trends and use patterns among the public, including use of new products, dual use, poly use, and switching from product to product. We want to be able to characterize tobacco initiation, dependence, cessation, and relapse patterns, and we want to monitor changes in risk perceptions and other attitudes around products and which products do people actually prefer. We want to compare intermediate endpoints, and ultimately we want to look at long-term health outcomes and cost-specific mortality. Right now this is a five-year contract, but our hope is to have this as a long-term longitudinal study. And we want to be able to assess differences among different critical subgroups such as youth and young adults, daily users of tobacco products, and again we're collecting biospecimens so we can analyze biomarkers. So here's just the sample sizes of some of the subgroups, the major subgroups. There's other ones as well, but we're going to have almost 17,000 youth enrolled in the study. We have about 11,000 young adults because we want to make sure that when we look at young, you know, we know that young adults are initiating tobacco, so we wanted to have a sufficient sample of young adults. We have about 24,000 current adult tobacco users, 3,300 dual users and smokeless tobacco users, and about 19,000 daily users. So we really drilled down because we want to be able to look at changes over time. And this is my last slide. I put this up here because the research opportunities right now, because we're working for with extramural research, this is the website at NIH for opportunities about extramural research funding. And with that, thank you very much.